Before we leap into today's show, let's just have a quick shout out to our sponsors who make it possible. First of all, thanks very much to Cumulus Networks for sponsoring us. You can find them at cumulusnetworks.com, straight up, Cumulus the Cloud. And what they're building is an operating system for your switch that absolutely does all the things that you know and love. It's straight up Linux so that it gives you the features and functions of Linux on your Ethernet switch. We'll talk more about them later in the show. And also thanks to ThousandEyes, who give you visibility, insights, and actionable intelligence into the user experience over any network. So whether it's an SD-WAN, whether it's a campus, whether it's in your private data center, it's on the internet, it's in the cloud, ThousandEyes can see, give you that visibility that you need. And if you go over to thousandeyes.com/packetpushers, you can snag a Blame the Network t-shirt. And so on with the show. Here it goes.
Welcome to the Packet Pushers Weekly Show. This week, you're getting Greg and Ethan, Ethan and Greg Unleashed. That's right. We are going to just yammer at each other about some things that are on our minds. And first up, we wanted to share with you some things about our membership site. If you've been on the Slack channel with us, if you've been following some of our tweets and blog articles, you may be aware that we've been working for quite some time on a membership site. That is a place that you can go and either at a free level or at a paid level, have access to content you can't get anywhere else on the Packet Pushers Network. So a couple of thoughts about this. One, you've asked the question, wonderful listeners, does that mean some of the things we get for free today are going to go away and we'll have to pay for them? No, it does not mean that. So if you're subscribed to the weekly show or priority queue, et cetera, you'll still be able to get all those things. None of that stuff's going to change. But the intent here is to provide a platform upon which we can deliver premium content
that you want,
and some free things too.
That you want to pay for. It comes down to, there's a big discussion in the outside world about what does the future of media look like. And what we know from music and from what Netflix is doing, that paying for membership systems is the only way to make content sustainable. Most people are paying for a Netflix or an Amazon Prime for Amazon Video or, you know, some sort of subscription service. Like, if you want good content, you have to pay for it somehow. So there's only two ways to pay for it. One is subscription models, which is all those companies I just talked about. And the other one is advertising. And the problem with advertising, ultimately, that it's, you're very dependent on the advertisers to set direction and set tone. Now, we think for the podcast that we've done up until now, we've managed to find a balance for integrity and honesty. And, you know, there are times when we need to talk about what, you know, the sponsor wants us to talk about. And there's times when we don't. And the only way that we can monetize times when we're not talking about sponsored products is for you to pay for it. Mm-hmm. So that's basically where the logic is.
And that's the big thing. As Greg says, right now our funding comes from sponsors, and you guys have been okay with the line we've tried to walk, where yes, it's sponsored content, and so we're going to be courteous and kind to our guests, but still work with them to develop content you actually want to listen to. And for the most part, when you talk to us about those shows, that's working. You like that. But we don't want to be dependent on those sponsor dollars to put food on the table, and therefore that's what this site's going to be. The site's going to be called Ignition. So if you hear us talking about Ignition and so on, that's the membership site. That's what we are referring to. Now, I mentioned two tiers. So there's going to be a free tier and there's going to be a paid tier. So the free tier, what is that good for? That we are going to be putting into the free tier content that may have come from a sponsor in some way, but we want to capture it somehow. And that would be like the virtual design clinic. So last month, Greg, we did the first virtual design clinic and some of that content was sponsored. Well, we'll pop that into the membership site, but at the free level. You're not going to have to pay to get that because the sponsor already paid to have it created. So we don't want to double dip in that way. And there may be other things that we want to sprinkle in there so that there's content you can get at freely. Like newsletters, we've been already doing that with Human Infrastructure Magazine, for example, and the link propagation. We may do other things that at that free level. But then at the paid level, there would be none of the content at the paid level would be sponsored. This is just Greg and Ethan and Drew and independent authors, whoever else may want to share content that you are willing to pay for, will be at that that premium level, if you will, of Ignition. So things that the site that we are building is set up for, video. We can do video work. We can do courses where we can do a multi-part series. Like I'm going to be working on some of the chapters I wrote in the book that I co-authored with Russ White. I'll be turning some of those into some courses that you can consume. written material, PDFs, so reports. Maybe we, as packet pushers, would write a report that would help you figure out how to handle SD-WAN or something like that. That would be the kind of a thing you could get from Ignition at the paid level.
Sort of. If you've read an analyst report, something like that, like a roundup of all the SD-WAN products and some commentary on each one and the different strengths and maybe some observations on the weaknesses of them. One of the things I know you've wanted to talk about, Ethan, is comparing switches. So if you had
we've talked about that for years, right? Having like a not a bake-off exactly, but more like a buyer's guide. So you kind of understand what's different about this switch versus this other switch. Yeah. You know, why look at this Cisco Nexus 9300 whatever versus this Arista model versus this white box model?
Yeah.
Giving you some insights into how to make those choices.
And those documents would have to be refreshed on a consistent basis. So you can't just write them once like a blog post, you know, comparing the Extreme such and such a switch versus the Juniper OC switch versus the Nexus 9300 or Nexus 3000, something like that, right? And they change over time. So to make that work, we have to keep paying somebody, probably. It will be, some of it will be Ethan and I, but increasing it'll be other people that we would reach out to write that content for us. So we'll actually become a publisher.
And the hope is that many of you are going to glom onto this idea. You're going to like it. The content we can provide there will be valuable to you, and you will be able to subscribe. Not going to be especially expensive, but it is a hope that those of you that have, for many of you, a surprising number of you actually, have asked, how can I give you guys money? This will be the way. This is the mechanism that you can use to pay us, if you will, to express your thankfulness for the content we create broadly, and then specifically the premium stuff we're going to be putting into Ignition.
And it's going to be written for a small audience or a targeted audience. And what we mean by that is when you have a small audience, you can't make money out of it like you can a CCNA course or, you know, some sort of introduction to networking course. You can sell that for, you know, $25 and you'll have 100,000 people signing up and you'll make money for it, right? But if you start talking about data center design, there's only a few thousand people in the world who actually design data centers in any given year, if you know. And so producing that content doesn't sell to a large audience. So it's not going to be cheap, but it is going to be theoretically fairly targeted into a certain set of directions that you want to be. And that'll be networking to start with, I think. And then we'll grow it if it's successful, you know. But it's going to be high-end design, which is not normally a moneymaker. You can't go to Pluralsight or O'Reilly and get designing your data center.
We're not going to be doing certification kind of stuff either. Now, some of the content we have may be applicable if you happen to be in a certification track, but this is not CCNA or CCNP training. That kind of thing isn't really a market that Greg and I want to get into. It's very competitive already. There's a lot of great content out there. We don't really think we have anything to add to that world. And that's not the kind of thing we really talk about on the show all that much. So we're trying to really cater to those of you that like the kinds of shows we put together on Packet Pushers and push that content. And Greg, just as you said, there's only so many of you out there that are in that world or aspire to be. So it is a bit of a limited audience, but we're hoping that there will be a strong uptake. Now, another thing that has come up with the existing membership site on our existing packetpushers.net has been complaints and concerns about lack of SSL or inconsistent SSL. Yes, the new Ignition site will be 100% SSL. Cert's already bought. It's already in place, already been tested. And we're just waiting to move the site from the developer sandbox into its new home. And one of the design requirements we have when I built the RFP for this site is SSL end-to-end, everything SSL. So that is one of the things that during beta testing, we're going to make darn sure that that is what is going on. So your credentials and whatever you're consuming on the site will be protected over the wire.
We'll get to the Packet Pusher site, packetpusher.net, the base site for where the podcast and the blogs and the news. That will continue, but that will be SSL'd in the near future.
I don't know about near future, but it's definitely happening. So actually, Greg, why don't we talk about that for a minute? So a few of you have noticed, because you've mentioned either on Twitter and our Slack channel, that you've had some challenges either getting to packetpushers.net or maybe you can't find a podcast or download a podcast or something because of performance problems. Yep, we know. Boy, do we know. And frankly, we're really upset about it. It's been on our minds heavily over the last several weeks as we're recording this. And it's a web hosting problem. You know, we don't have metal of our own. We don't like have servers in a colo somewhere that serves up the site. We use a hosting provider to provide that packetpushers.net for us. And that's not a bad story. And it, long story short, is the platform that we selected to do this started up about 3 years ago with great fanfare and promise and looked to be a great thing. But I don't, it doesn't seem, Greg, like it worked out for them. And so they've sort of abandoned it. It's not abandoned exactly. I mean, there's still support. It's still running. They still take our money. But it's just it none of the promises of what it was going to become and the sort of a platform it was going to be for people like us really ever came about. And now there's constant problems with performance where their solution to the problem is kind of restart our web instance. And then it comes back and everything's great.
Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Sounds like infrastructure IT vendors.
Promise for years how you'd fix Windows. Yes. Have you restarted it?
That's right. Kind of we're on top of it. They think they found a problem and hopefully it will get better. It took us a long time to gather up the evidence to point out that there's a problem. And we have an email today saying that found something, the instance that we're running is CPU rate limited or something. So hopefully that will get better. But if not, soon after the ignition site is stabilized, we'll probably start a transition to a new platform for that as well.
Yeah, it is something we're looking at seriously. But those of you that have ever run a site like this, we've got a few thousand articles in the database of this site. We've got nearly 1,000 podcasts that are tied up in this site. We've got hundreds of you that have contributed as community bloggers over the years. You know, your author accounts are all there on the site. And the site is what feeds our RSS feeds, which is how you actually get the podcasts in Apple Podcasts or Overcast. Overcast being just a great app if you haven't tried it.
If you're on iOS, listen on Overcast.
Yeah, for sure.
Although Apple Podcasts is getting better. Apparently, I was looking at a review for iOS 11.4. The thing that caught my eye that made me actually bother to look at it was somebody saying that substantial changes to the podcast app in 11.4. So possibly it'll be less sucky because certainly in the last couple of versions of iOS, the Apple Podcasts app has been taking big steps backwards, not forward. So,
But the way you get all of that content is via RSS, which is via packetpushers.net is at the root of it. It's more complex than that, but that's the guts of it is all packetpushers.net. So whenever we go to transition from our current provider to another, assuming that that's what we do, it's a big deal and it'll be a difficult change for us because there's just a lot of complexity and moving parts, gears and levers that make it go. It's a big thing for us, but as a small group, there's only so many problems we can tackle at a time, and getting ignition off the ground is at the top of that
list.
I lost
6 hours today troubleshooting problems on the sites and the,
yes, with and an the RSS
feeds,
feed.
And the RSS yes. feeds and then the social media feeds and then the... Yeah, because even when you publish a post, you have to send it to LinkedIn. We still send it to the Facebook page, but then we have to send it off to Twitter. Even then, some of those have secondary effects as well, and some of the pipes are actually combined. So we have the fat pipe, which is the four top podcast channels. Then we have the full feed, which is all of our podcast channels, Briefings in Brief, as well as the community channel, which hasn't done much lately. We're paying, I don't know, roughly a junior networking engineer salary for a web developer to redevelop sites and to maintain the sites now.
Something like that. It's costing us real money to do it. So, yes.
Thank you for helping us to do that, by the way.
So the long and the short of it is we're on these things and we're excited about Ignition getting launched and having content in there. And we're recording this on Wednesday for this show is actually going to go out on Friday, April 6th. Hopefully by the end of the month, maybe we'll have some official announcements about that. Same thing with Virtual Design Clinic videos. They will be tied up in that Ignition launch.
Huge success that was, by the way. Let's talk about the Design Clinic because that was a big success. We had 600 people register. We had
over that, like 640, I think. Yeah,
we had over 400 people attend. And we learned some lessons. 6 hours without a break is too long.
I really had to pee at the end.
Well, we figured that it would just be fine if people just got up and took a break and came back. Like if you need to leave.
Which is how we handled it in all sincerity. Yeah. If you needed to drop off, you dropped. But a lot of you gave us feedback, that 6 hours was just like you couldn't, there's no way you could attend the whole thing. And so you popped in with what you could. And we know that many of you have asked for and are waiting for the recordings. But everybody seemed to love the AMA, Greg.
Yeah. So the AMA, we did 2 hours of Ask Me Anything, and we had took questions from the web interface and then fed them to a panel, not just us, but other like real people who do real work, not just what we do. And that seemed to be popular. So we're going to do that again. We've got a plan to run another one in a month or two, once we get some more sponsors on board and get the planning underway. But we're going to break it up this time. We're going to do Ask Me Anythings, and then we're going to do some content, some presentations. And then we're going to do another Ask Me Anything where you can just take questions from the audience and we'll answer them live with a panelist of people who do networks. And then again, do some more presentations and then another hour of Ask Me Anything, because the Ask Me Anything was really popular.
But it won't be 6 hours. We'll make it more like 3 or 4 hours. We'll tighten it up quite
and
a bit.
And we'll have some breaks this time around.
So we did like that event. It went off well. And as Greg said, we'll do more of them as we can get more sponsors on board. It is costly for us to put the event on. We pay the people that participate, and we have to pay for the webinar platform itself. So in other words, it's not a free thing for us to just do for fun. It's like a business thing. So, we've got several sponsors that are interested, at least express some kind of an interest, and we'll work with them to try to make their content as usual good, not just rock on up with your marketing slides and go market.
Well, we don't want to see the CIO presentation. Yeah.
No, with the NASCAR slides. No,
we don't want that.
We'll do what we did last time. Dig in, go deep with the product, get technical. How is it useful to me? But by the way, if you're a sponsor listening to this and you didn't know we did this virtual design clinic thing and you're interested, sponsors at packetpushers.net, just let us know and we'll get you on the list and see if we can schedule an event with you as one of the featured sponsors for it.
Well, it's time to take a break and pay for some of those bills that we just talked about in the previous section. And today's sponsor is Cumulus Networks. Cumulus is bringing soul to data center networking. What they mean by soul is S-O-U-L, simple, open, untethered Linux. That's what Cumulus Networks does, Linux on your switches. Now, 85% of decision makers have said they're still several years away from reaching the full potential of digital transformation due to the legacy infrastructure. Your legacy infrastructure is holding you back. It's preventing you from moving forward because it's got old ways of doing things, CLIs that aren't very good at being software operated. And with up to one third of Fortune 50 and 1,000 customers worldwide, Cumulus Networks is already helping them to increase their networking efficiencies by up to 75%. The key part about Cumulus that you really want to think about from a technical point of view is that it's Linux. So the whole stack just runs like a Linux server, and you have Linux commands. You can do all the things that you do on a Linux operating system you bring to the switch. There's just a few extra commands related to the networking part of it. Of course, you have Ethernet interfaces, so each switch interface looks like a Linux Ethernet interface. But Cumulus has been developing the product and getting past that. Now they're developing tools like NetQ, which is actually an SDN controller type environment to manage large fleets of Cumulus. So if you want to have a unified operations tool to bring your Cumulus into an orchestrated system, just like you've seen our other vendors do, Cumulus has that. And they're saying that customers are seeing total cost of ownership reduced by 60% at the same time as they get the freedom to choose from 70 hardware vendors. That's right. You can choose any hardware, and it's the same operating system on top. Cumulus Networks has a bunch of really good blog posts and really good articles that can help you get started learning Linux for the data center networking today, and they're free. We've got a link for you today. It's cumulusnetworks.com/pplearnlinux. And there's a free comprehensive guide there which will give you a starting point for Linux. And I got to say, some of the documentation that Cumulus puts out is actually worth reading. I do kind of make a point of reading what they have myself personally to keep me up to date on what's happening in the world of Linux. So if you go to cumulusnetworks.com/pplearnlinux, you'll get access to a free comprehensive guide that you can do to bring yourself up to speed if you've never worked on Linux before. Thanks to Cumulus for sponsoring the Packet Pushers.
So, Greg, I was at Aruba Atmosphere last week out in Las Vegas at the Mandalay Bay again, a casino floor, which I have been to so many times now that walking across from the hotel, you know, that big walk you have to do from the hotel to the convention
center. The first time you do it, it's a horror show because you see all those weird people hanging around.
Oh, yeah. So anyway, Aruba Atmosphere 2018, I went as a delegate of Tech Field Day along with several other people. These other people were deep wireless experts. I certainly know my way around a wireless network, but I'm not as smart as a lot of these folks were. So it was nice to be able to sit, talk to some Aruba people, get some deep dives, and listen to some of the insightful questions from some of the smartest wireless people that I know. Now, a lot of topics came up that were interesting, but one in particular I wanted to mention that is just to kind of highlight that this is a thing that's coming is WPA3. I have lots of notes I took on this, and I'm going to be doing some deeper writing about it. But WPA3 has been announced by the what do they call it? The Wi-Fi Alliance, I guess, which is a consortium of vendors that work together in agreement on what standards should look like. And WPA3's been not finally ratified, but is coming in 2018, where that will be announced as a replacement to WPA2. So a few points here that I learned while at Atmosphere and listening to a presentation by Dan Harkins. Dan being, I think he is a fellow within Aruba. That's an official, or maybe he was a distinguished engineer. But anyway, he is responsible for some of the, one of the main minds behind some of these protocols that are going to be tied up in WPA3, and was presenting to us, also an IETF RFC author for some of these things, and raised a lot of points. WPA3 is going to be a software change primarily. This is not a, you know, you go, Greg, with 802.11, whatever the standard is, you need new radios, new hardware, new clients to be able to go there.
Yep.
Not the case with WPA3. This is a software issue. It's driven by the fact that WPA2 personal is broken, completely broken now. And then WPA2 enterprise is solid, but depending on how you implement it, it is fairly easy to implement it in an insecure way. And so WPA3 is aiming to change all of that stuff, deal with the broken WPA2 personal, and then make it so that it is impossible to deploy it in an unsecure way. So a few highlights here of things, if you want to start researching this as you're listening, you might be interested in. One is, in WPA3 world, there is going to be no such thing as an open network, where, you know, today you can go into a coffee shop and it's open, there's no password, or if there is a password, it's published so that you can write it down, you know, it's on the table on a little stand or something, and you can get into it that way. So there's no real security there. Well, open networks like this are going to be replaced by something called OWE, opportunistic wireless encryption. You just get encryption, you don't need to know a password, and there's a whole protocol that is built around this. And if you want to dig in to OWE, RFC 8110. And Dan was, Dan Harkins, one of the authors there, was standing in front of us talking about it. And he's referred to in Aruba also. I mentioned fellow, maybe he was a distinguished engineer, I forgot, but he's also considered an inventor. So a great guy to hear from that. So there you go, OWE, part of the WPA3 spec, RFC 8110. Get a look on it, get a look at it. And
this is one of those interesting technologies where you look at WPA and you look at what they got wrong. And it's a really interesting exercise to understand what they got wrong with two, and then to see what three is and what it fixes. It's one of those times when you look at protocols as they evolve over time. And there's a lot to be learned in terms of fundamentals about what they got wrong. And what. And so if you ever see that again in a standard, you should go, that standard's not gonna work. The IEEE has produced a lot of standards over the year, and an awful lot of them never went anywhere. It's not like every IEEE or every IETF standard actually got traction. The vast majority of them don't go anywhere. And looking at these failures could help you be a better engineer, but also be able to pick winners, when you should invest and double down on a technology and when not.
Yeah, you're really nailing this here. Dan brought up many points related to exactly what you just said. Like, here's things we know we did wrong in WPA2 and how we're fixing them in WPA3. So that open... opportunistic wireless encryption is one of those things. Another is addressing what the cipher suites are that are available when you're going through negotiations between client and AP. And they're making it that there's no opportunity going to be given to come up with a partially secure solution, where maybe you pick your encryption right, but then SHA-1 becomes part of the equation, which is broken. And so you end up with an insecure connection. Those cipher suites are going to be enforced in such a way that you can only have a truly secure connection within WPA3 and WPA3 enterprise. So that's, again, all of that is coming. WPA3 is coming. There is some work being done in WPA3 related to IoT. So device provisioning protocol, DPP is one of those. And there's a good bit out there about that. If you search for DPP, that's not extremely new.
Couldn't they use the one that we're already using, like ONI or iPixie, the one that Cisco's threatening to use? And like, why do we have to reinvent the wheel again for a provisioning protocol?
This one has to do with the fact that it's an IoT device that is coming up via wireless, and how does it do that in a most secure method? So DPP is addressing that very specific scenario, because you're right, we already have all of these other things. So what is, you know, like,
but iPixie does all, you know, it does. Yeah, I know that. Yes, for wireless, there's no, at least with iPixie, it's going to DHCP and find its boot server and away it rolls.
With DPP, it's all about this IoT device that isn't connected to a wireless network, and how does it do
surely they could extend something instead of if you're going to reinvent the wheel, try and use a wheel that's already out there. Why?
That may be a valid case. I don't know exactly. That didn't come up, and we know that what happens in a lot of these standards bodies is, if it ain't mine, it can't be good, so I'm going to do mine. And you know what yours ends up looking like is like what three other people that already came up with something looked like, because we can't all play nicely together.
Yeah, well, you know, it's like only was invented because we needed a generic boot mechanism for switches, Ethernet switches, right? And now we're seeing iPixie because Pixie is used for servers. So if you've got a data center with 100,000 servers in it, you don't want to have scripts written for Pixie and then have a completely different system for switches. All right, well, okay. So what we need is a convergence on one. Why do I need to keep reinventing this wheel?
I know with DPP, they are addressing very specific scenarios, IoT being one of them. And that's the process of, well, how do I take this thing and make sure, A, it's supposed to be allowed on my network? How do I make sure that happens? And then as it's coming up on the wireless network, make sure that all phases of the negotiation are secure. And so there's several things unique to the fact that it's coming up on wireless as opposed to wired that I think make DPP unique. And I understood the problems that they were solving as they described it, but it's got to be a very technical presentation. I took lots of notes, but didn't get all the details right in my head because it becomes quite complex. As you go through each phase, there's a number of pieces and parts to talk about the bootstrapping process, what the authentication and the message exchange process looks like, and then the configuration you end up with. And then now that I'm on, what's my network access look like?
Sure.
But again, DPP is supposed to be ready. Well, as we're recording this, sometime this month, theoretically, April 2018, where the DPP certification process for devices will begin, and then DPP capable devices hitting the market later this year in 2018. Again, all of that coming under the very broad umbrella of WPA3. If you start digging around the internet, you're not going to find much yet, because most of what the coverage is and discussions are just around the announcement from the Wi-Fi Alliance, which doesn't give a lot of details. So I got kind of an early peek here from Dan Harkins, listening to that presentation. Another kind of a sidecar reference here would be Suite B, where if you're looking at deep government level, military grade encryption and a security standard for wireless, Suite B comes up in this WPA3 conversation as well, that I found to be kind of an interesting topic that you might want to research.
Wireless continues to be pretty specialist. I think you need to be focused on it. You can't stay in touch from a distance, I think.
Oh, man. And that, as I was sitting in the room with some of these guys, like Sam Clemens and several of these other guys that are trainers, and they just, Blake Crony, they just live in this world of wireless full time. And the kinds of questions they were asking and the level of knowledge you need to know, Greg, I completely agree with you. It is definitely a discipline that can be all you do, and it can keep you plenty busy, because getting it right is so complicated.
I tried to get a wireless podcast, but we're still looking for the right people. Yeah, it is a specialist area, but it's very difficult, and it's very, very difficult to explain to people without a certain basic knowledge set. Networking is, you know, data networking or wired networking is a lot simpler, I think, overall.
Well, my thanks to Aruba and to Tech Field Day for giving me the opportunity to attend and listen to some smart people talk. And I'm going to be developing some content based around the things I learned at the event, which was good stuff.
But did they put on the fancy keynote thing? Did they do the big fancy keynote thing that they usually do?
Buddy, you have no idea. So the opening keynote, they parade everybody in there, and it was full on, you couldn't believe. Three massive screens across the front. There were dancers, like in the flash, physical dancers. There was a full-blown video production with Aruba employees that were there in like climbing gear, trying to make the point that, you know, you're climbing with Aruba and you'll keep climbing and your business can grow and, you know, all this kind of stuff, lights and video screens, everybody jumping around and wild applause and the whole thing.
And then the CEO comes on stage and goes, thanks everyone for that. Is that right?
A little bit of that. Yeah. I mean, Kearney is a great guy. I've ever talked to him on purpose, but he seemed almost like overwhelmed by the spectacle that had been created. That's right.
It's like, if you really want to, like, I'm all in favor of a big show. Well, actually, I'm not, because I do think it's a bit wasteful and pointless, because it doesn't make a point to really, we're here to talk about something else, but we're not here to see Las Vegas. If I want to go to Blue Man Group, I'll go to Blue Man Group. But
buddy, we were in Las Vegas, and so we were. Yeah, that's what happened.
But
it was fine.
It was a letdown when the people get on stage and go, "And we've got a new wireless product," and hold up a white box.
So this is actually a really good point for me to make here about Aruba. Since we're talking about them, and I was at their show last week. When you first think of Aruba, what do you think of as a company? What do they do?
Well, wireless. That's what they
do. Well, wireless, right. Well, that's a perception that the world has. But in fact, they do a lot more stuff. They actually have a lot of other infrastructure products. Yeah. And we don't have to dive deep on this at all. I just wanted to raise it that they are puzzling as Aruba. How do they change the public perception of them as a wireless company? Because that may be their primary service, but they're also deep into the security world, maybe centered around wireless infrastructure, but they have a lot of security products, including ClearPass, that I know a lot of people that have used it tend to compare it favorably to Cisco ICE, for example. That's come up several times in our Slack channel with different people. And then the other thing they have is switching infrastructure, and they have switch operating systems, and they are getting into APIs and SDN around those switch operating systems that are rather robust and forward thinking. And you look at the architecture and you go, oh yeah, these guys don't just make APs, they're making switching infrastructure too. So it's,
well, they're building a campus. They've been moving into that campus infrastructure for some time. Like when we were there 2 years ago, was it 2 years we went there together and recorded some shows? They were announcing their first generation campus products. And I think it comes back to this. We want to buy, customers expect with wireless to just buy an end-to-end. And so if you're buying Aruba and then plugging it into somebody else's switches, then Aruba's not in control of that. And I think it's kind of sad that our switches are so incompatible with each other that you can't trust them to work together. You know, you would have thought that Ethernet would be a standard by now.
I think what you're alluding to here is that there is, with Aruba, a better together story. So yes. I was at the launch for their 8400 chassis switch that they put together running Aruba OS CX, I think, whatever the designator is. That's modular and API driven and so on. And I think maybe if Aruba starts telling that story, that they don't just sell APs, they can do your whole campus network. Yeah, they've got a lot of, there is truly an interesting story to tell there.
Yeah, but at the same time, if a customer comes to Aruba and says, we want you to do an entire university campus, and they say, yes, what, you want to plug my Wi-Fi into your campus backbone? Well, at that point, the campus backbone becomes a problem. Right, because you've got to rely on the campus backbone to be reliable and stable and to have enough bandwidth for all the Wi-Fi and blah, blah, blah. So it makes sense for them to say, we can only offer you a guarantee if we actually do all the story. Let's take a pause here and thank our sponsor, ThousandEyes. You've heard of ThousandEyes. We've done a number of podcasts with them, and they give you visibility, insights, and actionable intelligence into user experience right across the network. Now, the thing about it is that everybody's embracing the cloud, and whether it's a SaaS or Office 365 or Salesforce or putting workloads in Azure or AWS, there's big advantages for businesses to move into the cloud, and you're just going to struggle, right? If you're part of the ops team or the architecture team, service delivery is a problem. How are you going to know where things are? How do you order it? What's the security? What's the value of those services? And where's the performance problem if your network is spread across the internet, across vast geographical regions? How do you know? And the only way really to keep an eye on those networks is to build out a visibility and analytics infrastructure that gives you the visibility into those networks that you don't control, so that when the tickets come in and you get crushed, you have a tool. ThousandEyes is a tool that does exactly that. It generates performance data through active monitoring from global vantage points all over the internet. They have nodes all over the internet constantly monitoring the internet so they can tell you if there's an outage in some place or another. They also are able to correlate multiple layers of performance data, not just from the layer 2, layer 3, layer 4 by pings or open TCP opens. They're actually monitoring BGP routing and DNS lookups to radically identify the way you have problems. So much more around the user experience than the networking experience, which I think is really important. You can share those saved events, not just with yourself or within your team, but also to third parties. So if you're buying bandwidth from an internet provider and you're getting consistently bad performance, you can show that out to somebody else. And because they aggregate anonymous real-time data from thousands of sources that they can build, this collective data set that they collect from internet and everything, they can now generate insights about large-scale issues across the internet, including large-scale at their severity, breadth, and likely root cause. So they can actually pinpoint which part of the internet backbone is down because they're collecting data from so many people across the world. That's why you should be thinking about ThousandEyes. It helps organizations deliver those business-critical services by giving you visibility and intelligence from every user to every app over the network. Now, there's a special offer just for Packet Pushers listeners. You can try ThousandEyes for free at www.thousandeyes.com/packetpushers. And if you say you're from the Packet Pushers, you can get a free, cool ThousandEyes t-shirt. So manage every network like it's your own, even the ones you don't own or you're only renting. ThousandEyes, thrive in a connected world. And thanks very much to ThousandEyes for sponsoring the Packet Pushers.
Okay, so enough with Aruba. I wanted to move on, Greg, to an announcement that was made on April 1st and was carefully noted. This is not an April Fool's Day joke. This is a real thing, and that is Cloudflare's announcement of the Quad 1 DNS server that they have made.
Why announce it on April 1 if it's going to be not a joke?
You know, April 1st, I got victimized again by very plausible sounding blogs that at the end, it was like the middle finger goes up, April Fool's, screw you. It's like, I just spent 5 minutes reading and pondering this thing to have you guys tell me it's a lie.
Yeah.
I should know
I don't appreciate April Fool's. I think just to jump it aside there, I think a culture where pranking is acceptable leads to negative outcomes on the whole. It's all fine and funny when no one gets hurt, but people do get hurt. In fact, the whole YouTube pranking thing, where people genuinely do get hurt, is a sign of where if you start with little pranks, then you end up with big pranks and you end up with people in hospital. Or killing. Remember those, there was a couple that shot, the wife shot her husband through a book because they thought that they'd do a YouTube prank, she'd shoot it, the book would stop the bullet. And of course the bullet went straight through and he's dead. That's where pranking takes you. So
I didn't heard that story.
Well, you know, that's where pranking culture leads to. People, you know, have hurt people and put people in hospital with pranks of some sort or another. And I think that April Fool's leads you down that path. It's a bit like, you know, there's many other things in life which does the same sort of thing. So be aware of it. So the things about the Quad 1 announcement the good things about it is that Cloudflare has set out to make the fastest DNS server because the Google DNS is fast, but it's not as fast as it could be because they don't have that many resolvers. They don't. Yes, they use Anycast for Google, but they don't put them everywhere.
Yeah, they've set out to make the fastest DNS service. I think the jury's still out on whether they are the fastest DNS servers at this point.
Yeah.
So I got into this on Twitter a little bit with several people and just kind of doing some ping tests from our various locations around the world. Was it faster to ping Quad 1 or was it faster to ping Quad 8? I mean, 8.8.8.8, mm-hmm. which is the Google DNS server service that many, many people use as an external recursive. And generally speaking, Quad 1 was 5 to 10 milliseconds closer to most of us than the Quad 8. But the question is, does that mean you're getting faster DNS resolution?
Usually, yes.
Yes.
So there's two parts to a DNS query. There's latency and then there's server performance. Surprise. And so Google may well have better DNS performance. But Google's only got like 50 or 60 data centers around the world and Cloudflare's getting up towards 200. The chances are that the latency to the DNS server will be much less for a Cloudflare instance than it would be to a Google. Chances are.
And in my specific case, that was true. And it was fairly straightforward. I did some trace routes and found out the closest Google DNS server to me is in New York City. I'm in rural New Hampshire, if you care to draw out a map. The Cloudflare server was in Boston. So a substantial number of physical miles closer. Not that that always means that it's closer by wire, but in this case it was. And I was seeing, I think, 5-ish millisecond better response time. 1.1.1.1 is a controversial IP address among network engineers. Many of you in Slack got really bent out of shape because well, geez, that's where my captive portal IP address is for my Cisco wireless LAN and my Aerohive wireless LAN. Both confirmed, a number of people confirmed that this is embedded right in documentation from Cisco and Aerohive. And the history here is that the 1.0.0.0/8 network was not a public network for many years and became public. It was assigned to AppNIC to be used on the public internet in 2010, I think. Mm-hmm. And even then, the 1.0.0.0/24 and 1.1.1.0/24 networks were reserved for experimental purposes within AppNIC, that you could use it, but it wasn't, you know, something that you would expect to see.
It was implicit. It was accepted that we've been using it for things for years. Like, I would tell you that there's probably more than 100 firewall clusters out there that I've deployed, and the sync link between the two is 1.1.1/30. 1.1.0/30, yes? Like, so where you actually sync two firewalls together over an IP connection, that I've been using 1.1.1, and if you're still doing that to this day, you're never going to get a DNS query out because that's an interface on those firewalls.
That's right, depending on where those firewalls are positioned. But yeah, transit traffic in theory would get dumped right to what that firewall sees as a local interface. Mm-hmm. And right, your DNS query is not going to get responded to that way.
Yeah.
Same thing with captive portals. If the AP is supposed to be grabbing outbounds to 1.1.1.1, you're not going to be able to pump a DNS query through that device if it is expecting to respond to that IP locally.
Yep.
How big of a problem is this? You know, it's a problem for some people. It just is. Other people, you may never even notice it because you might be using that quad one internally for something, but if you're not announcing it anywhere and doesn't happen to be a transit device, quad one DNS service might work just fine for you.
Sure. And they've also got IPv6 services, 2.6.0.6.4700.4700.1.1.1 and 1.0.0.1. One of the interesting things I noticed about this is they're actually implementing some neato features. So Cloudflare has been participating at the ITF, specifically in a number of different things, but in this case, they're talking about doing DNS over HTTPS. The big reason behind this is that DNS remains a highly spoofable protocol. Because it's UDP, it's unencrypted, anybody can force it to be a spoof. And if you're Cloudflare and you're a content delivery network with a DNS service, you're seeing a lot of wasted capacity of DNS lookups that are spoofed, right? Or websites being attacked that are spoofed. So doing DNS over HTTPS or TLS means that the DNS query is encrypted. People can't sniff them off the wire. So this is what Verizon and AT&T are doing, what all the telcos are doing. They're sniffing your DNS queries and then selling that data off to ad tech companies, number one. Number two, people who run DNS services use the DNS as a way of collecting threat intelligence data, but they also take that data and then sell it off to other people. So if you can set yourself up as a DNS hosting company, you've actually now got a lot of data that you can sell about which is the biggest website on the internet, where are people going, you've got malware. So we're seeing a lot of this co-opting of the DNS technology for that goes against the sort of privacy assumption that what you do on the internet is, moderately.
It's been no secret that Google harvests that data. That's kind of an assumption that if you're using 8888 and 8844, right, they're harvesting that data for their own ad delivery purposes and so on.
Juniper bought one recently to boost up its threat intelligence capabilities, blah, blah, blah. Everybody's going to have a DNS server. Using HTTPS means the network can't take that data. So you've got to trust your DNS provider one way or the other. Today, the telcos are monitoring the internet, collecting DNS statistics and matching it up with your personal data and then selling it off to ad tech companies. Now, there's no guarantee that this will get up, but this server now supports a working implementation of DNS over HTTPS to try and drive acceptance of it. They're also doing some modern DNSSEC. Keep in mind that I think DNSSEC is probably dead. Don't know what you think about it, but I don't think it's reached critical mass. It's so difficult.
I mean, the last post I read was by Jeff Huston about this, who works with AppNIC and writes in some detail about what's going on. And the trends are beginning to actually go down a bit for DNSSEC adoption. So,
if you figure that there's encryption libraries available for HTTPS everywhere, and they are solved cryptography problems, if you like eyes on the code, why are we implementing new crypto libraries in DNSSEC when we can just go and use the HTTPS ones? That's actually a compelling argument to me. We could do DNS over HTTPS it's going to require significantly, like all the DNS servers would now have to become HTTPS servers, but it does mean that the whole cryptography problem goes away. Like the problems of DNSSEC and key rotation and key role, that all gets much simplified in a HTTPS world, I think.
I think so. And right, the fact that Cloudflare is encouraging this behavior is makes it an interesting offering. I got to go back through and read a couple of their fairly detailed posts on how they're implementing these servers and what they intend to do with the information. But it didn't feel like it was going to be this massive harvesting. It was more for the betterment of the internet in the context of yes. filtering out insecure sites and helping to avoid redirection and DNS poisoning attacks and these kind of things.
Cloudflare made the point that they are actually rotating the DNS logs every 30 days. So once you do a query, 30 days later, that query deletes, then deliberately not keeping the data. So it is a privacy thing. But I'm talking about DNS over HTTPS. And if you think about it, like today, if you want to sign your DNS with DNSSEC, you have to go and get a whole new crypto key. But if you're doing HTTPS, you've probably already got an SSL certificate, probably from Let's Encrypt. Why don't you use that for your DNS? Right, to validate that you own that domain.
Well, I know there's some very opinionated people in our Slack channel about how exactly these things are supposed to go. So I see a new podcast in our future, maybe on DataNauch channel. I don't know. Yes. We'll have to figure that out. It's a discussion worth having. Now, another DNS service worth mentioning, Greg, is Quad9. They announced a few months back. So they're out there as well trying to make the internet a better place as far as DNS goes. And some people had done some performance testing to Quad9 and it depended. Some people found it about as performant as Quad1. Some people found it more or less with Google Quad8 services. So, hey, there's Quad1 DNS and we're just making you aware of that as an interesting thing. Maybe we'll get someone from Cloudflare on to have that discussion. Maybe we can get Jeff Huston on to talk about DNSSEC and maybe DNS over HTTPS.
Yep, we can open up the discussion. But I'm not offering answers, but I actually, generally, I've sort of been thinking about DNS over TLS for a couple of years now, and I've come to the conclusion it's probably where we want to be. DNSSEC was a good – the idea of using any – everything's going to be over HTTP eventually. So we might as well just roll the DNS lookup over HTTP too. Got a question for you. We saw the Open Networking Summit come up recently.
Boy, did we. So many announcements.
Yeah,
yes.
We saw like Claymore Mines go off in the press release area of like announcements around open source. But I'm beginning to see that we're reaching peak – open source. Is there any room? The question in my mind is there any more room for new open source projects to emerge that offer us something that we don't, right? So
like standards bodies, Greg, my perception of a lot of these open source projects is if we didn't make it, we don't want it. So now we've ended up with all of these different projects out there, different switch abstraction layers, different network operating systems, different architectures to allow you to roll your own open networking. And I don't know if that's good or bad necessarily, but it does seem as a practitioner like you'd want to be able to zoom in on just two or three choices, but there's more like a dozen or more. Is that what you're getting at with the peak
I think
idea?
I think there's a few things that we're seeing. One of those, we're seeing a lot of shakeout in the open source project. Like we saw Contrail be renamed to Tungsten and then handed over to the Linux Foundation. Contrail's been very useful for containers and OpenStack implementations for providing an overlay and open source networking capability. We've seen Open Daylight is now in the Linux Foundation. OpenFV, Panda, SNAS, P4 is now attached to the Linux Foundation networking. And then also Cisco's FD.io, which is the vSwitch technology that they want to have.
We did a deep dive on that a while back,
And then the last one is Open Network Linux, which still sits outside the Linux Networking Foundation. But if you sort of put all those together, Open Daylight, ONAP, OpenFV, all those things, what's left? We still haven't quite – FBOSS is coming. We've seen Sonic. Microsoft's talking about open sourcing Sonic. So that's the rest of the white box stack is – we've got to go through a convergence process. I don't think we want too many open source projects. I don't want to be – do you remember in the early 2000s we had hundreds of distros, Linux distros? It just didn't help anybody.
I'll tell you what I'm looking for really is a standard – a standard build. So I can take a white box, throw my OS on there, whatever that's going to be. I think at the moment it's Open Network Linux, and then throw whatever NAS I want on top of that.
Yes.
And we've talked to many of these folks, Greg. We know that the challenge is bigger than you think to be able to talk to a switch networking hardware and talk to all the interfaces and talk to the fans and talk to the CPUs and so on and present a consistent layer up to the network operating system. It's sort of a big deal because not every hardware piece of hardware is the same. There's a significant time and code investment and onboarding to make that happen. But for me personally, that's what I'm looking for. I want to put that NAS on there. I want to focus on the NAS. What NAS is going to solve my business problem?
What protocols do I
need, and how do I operate it? How do I manage it? Make those decisions and not have to worry about the box so much. I want the box to be what it is, just a commodity, you know, something that's straightforward. And I want the thing to forward at wire speed for me. And the magic be how I manage it and how I control it.
Yes. And we've already seen that to some extent. So maybe we're seeing a lot of somebody described it as gray box to me the other day, where vendors are putting their operating systems on open white boxes. So we saw Cisco announce iOS XR as a disaggregated, you can buy it software only to run on.
Quietly announced, but yes, they announced it.
You know, and I kind of feel that all of the fundamental shifts that open source is going to give us, they're all on the table now. We can see them. We've got virtual switches, we've got Open Daylight for SDN controllers, we've got ONAP to orchestrate above that, we've got open source monitoring, open source statistics and analytics, we've got
all the pieces of the puzzle.
Sonic,
you're saying,
and FBOSS, we've got Google that announced their code at ONS about what they're going to, you know, all that stuff, right? And I think all of those pieces are in play, and now that we've seen the disaggregation, so instead of the networking mainframe, you know, you go to Cisco, you buy their hardware with their operating system with their networking apps on top. And you can have any switch you like as long as it's the one that they're going to sell you. So like the old IBM mainframe model. Now we've seen the x86s arrive and you buy whatever operating system. But now the bundle starts to come back together. So we've disaggregated or unbundled the networking stack. And now the question is, what's the market going to get behind? Is it going to get behind an x86 model where it's the Intel x86 is the common component, but you can buy your servers from anyone and there's premium servers and white box servers? Or is the market going to say, well, we want to buy branded hardware, but have a choice of operating system on the top of? So maybe I'm going to buy a Cisco switch or a HPE switch or a Dell open networking switch, but I'm going to run Cumulus or Pika 8 or, you know.
There's so much education to happen to even have businesses think in those terms. Yeah. Most of the market, depends on how you define market. If we're talking about market monetarily, that's a very different conversation. We're talking about market as far as the number of individual customers, as we know. Mm. And most of the customers that are out there have no concept of open networking or disaggregation, I think. Maybe people do the show, sure. But the average person, they're working on their VAR relationship that's selling them an integrated Cisco or Juniper or Arista sort of solution, as opposed to, hey, did you guys know that you can do this disaggregated thing and roll your own? No one's selling that.
Now, the weird flip side to this is that you can look at VMware NSX and it doesn't care what hardware's there. But they're actually paving over all of that stuff by saying, we don't care what the hardware is. Like, we're going to put
over such a perfect metaphor.
SDN controllers that we're seeing, like the campus one that Cisco wants to put out. We've got plenty. Like, look what Apstra's doing, putting a controller over fairly much anybody's hardware. We're seeing the wireless vendors head down in the same space. It's certainly possible for SDN platforms to just say, you just put a switch in there, and there's places where you use expensive vendor A switch because that's important to you. And there's places where you get a white box and you drop some open source, open networking Linux. And the SDN controllers should work on both because they should all support the same APIs and have roughly the same feature set.
A lot of buyers aren't going to buy on should work and so on. I think what is needed is education, reference models, and some supportability that can begin to, I don't want to say standardize, but maybe make more predictable what putting together an open networking solution like this is all about. So just worth mentioning the Open Enterprise Foundation. So that's our friend Peyton, who was on the first virtual design clinic, is much of the energy behind the OEF. And that's part of the goal there, as I understand it, is education and helping people take some of the FUD out of it so that you would know what an open and disaggregated switching solution looks like as compared to a Cisco or a Juniper, let's call it traditional, vertically integrated network stack. I think that education has got to happen so that people can be go, oh, I get how this works. Oh, okay, yeah, we could do this. This would be okay. I'm not scared now. But until we get there, I don't know, man. I think it still feels like a specialist play unless you're a hyperscaler.
Yeah, well, I agree. And I increasingly think that also we've got to take into account the public cloud. A lot of people are just going to go and drop stuff into AWS, GCP, Azure. If you're a Western company, and if you're not, you'll be in some place in China. Your SDN controller needs to manipulate their networking just as well as it does whatever's on your premise, like especially in your data center, but potentially your SD-WAN too. So are we headed into a world where your SD-WAN controller actually configures the network in your hybrid cloud?
I don't know about your SD-WAN controller, but you know, a controller certainly.
Something
we're already
needs to.
Seeing that. That's happening.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be your data center SDN controller. It could be an SD-WAN. Like NSX could easily start manipulating AWS VPCs or Google GCP networking. Why not? And, you know, VeloCloud's already halfway there with what the, you know, NSX acquired VeloCloud. Why not just let them do it? And then customers just have branch networks and cloud. Really, that's what you want. I think the SD-WAN is a much more natural hybrid cloud solution than trying to make your data center wind into the AWS.
Well, buddy, why don't we wind up the show for today? A lot of what we just talked about are shows that are coming up that tie into edge computing. We've got a show we're planning on edge computing and what that looks like. There are discussions. We've had a lot of hybrid vendors and orchestration products that tie into hybrid cloud, what that looks like. We got a show coming up on AWS networking from the inside. We've actually got that interview recorded, and it's going through the editing machinations before that comes out. All of that stuff has a bearing on this, what the next generation of data centers looks like, because it's all still in flux. Dude, this is what our whole show has been for like 8 years now. Charting all of the changes and how it's all in flux and nothing's settled down yet. Not yet.
No, not yet. But we're working on it. We keep changing our minds.
And that's not a bad thing. It's sometimes it's exhausting, but most of the time it's kind of fun. Oh, who did what this week? Oh, no, right.
Most of the time it's exhausting, and most of the time it's kind of fun too. that's how I think of it.
It's fun for all of you that are listening. So, hey, thanks a lot for listening to Packet Pushers today. This has been Greg and Ethan Unleashed.
And just a quick word to say thanks to our sponsors today. Remember, it was Thousand Eyes who've got the visibility and insights and intelligence into the user experience from every user to every application on the network, so you can smoothly migrate to the cloud. Hit them up at thousandeyes.com/packetpushers, and you can pick up a free Blame the Network t-shirt. And also Cumulus Networks, who are doing web scale networking for the digital age. Their website is cumulusnetworks.com/pplearnlinux, and you'll access free comprehensive guides on Linux in terms of a networking context. And remember that Cumulus Linux has got soul. A simple, open, untethered Linux. That's where Cumulus Networks comes in. Thanks to them for sponsoring it and making this show possible.
Find this and many more of our fine and free technical podcasts and our community blog that's engineers just like you writing about what they do and hopefully sharing some wisdom that can help you in your networking. All at packetpushers.net. We're on Twitter at Packet Pushers, and we're also on LinkedIn. We still kind of lurk around Facebook here and there. And, you know, if you would take a minute, rate us on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, as they call it nowadays. That helps raise our little podcast network up and rank us. And when we get ranked, more and more people are aware of Packet Pushers, and that's good for us. And so we'd appreciate it if you take a time to rate us there. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.